Welcome to the Championship Sportscast. I'm Kempson Cross. That's John Thomas across from me. Say hello.
Stop.
And Brandon coming in via Skype.
And I'm Brandon Lee in California.
There you go. That's Brandon Lee. And our first topic of the day here on the Championship Sportscast is Super Bowl 49, that duel in the desert that lived up to the hype and more. The New England Patriots taking down the Seattle Seahawks 28-24 in an instant classic. There was an ugly ending, but we'll get to that later. And the MVP was Tom Brady, who was 37-50 for 328, four touchdowns. Two picks that seemed costly, but again, some mental toughness from the all-time great that is Tom Brady, as he surpassed Joe Montana in several different records, Super Bowl records. He's now won four Super Bowls, which ties him with Joe. Three Super Bowl MVPs tied with Joe, and surpassed Montana with a new Super Bowl career record of 13 touchdowns, 52 touchdowns in the throughout the whole entire playoffs.
Guys, this was a crazy Super Bowl, and Tom Brady also set another record for most throws in a game, which was 50 for the Super Bowl.
Most attempts, really? Joe Flacco didn't have that.
He set 50.
He should change his name to January Flacco, really, because to stay on the Super Bowl like I said, it was instant classic. And JT, what was your biggest takeaway from this thing?
Marshawn Lynch and Tom Brady. I mean, Tom Brady was spectacular, and Marshawn Lynch was doing Marshawn Lynch things. I mean, 24 carries for 102 yards, 4.2 average, pretty good with one TD. Probably should have been two touchdowns had it not been for the craziness at the end of the game. But I think we'll probably get to that here in a minute, I would imagine. But Marshawn Lynch looked incredible. He was really imposing his will pretty well. The Seahawks offense looked really good for parts of the game. Obviously, Tom Brady looked good, but I think my biggest takeaway is, and it's been something I've been saying about the Seahawks for a while, is that they are an incredible team in terms of like their offense. I mean, their wide receivers are probably their weakest spot. They could definitely use some actual like big name wide receivers, and that offense would be really scary. But the Russell Wilson Marshawn Lynch tandem, I've always thought, has been a really interesting one throughout the season. And it's kind of been my opinion that Russell Wilson is made special by a lot of the things that Marshawn Lynch does, and it's kind of starting to cement the fact that like Russell Wilson does great in a lot of his games, but if you look at the NFC Championship game and some of the other bodies of work that he has, that really what makes him truly scary is that you have the defense that's too busy worrying about what to do with Marshawn Lynch rather than what to do with Russell Wilson, and it sets up some of these really spectacular things. You didn't see a lot of it as much in the Super Bowl. I kind of attribute that a little bit to Bill Belichick's greatness as a head coach. Because, I mean, he's arguably the best ever. But it just kind of solidified in my mind the fact that how much of a threat Marshawn Lynch is. Because when Russell Wilson ran the ball, he averaged about 13 yards for the three times he did end up running the ball. It was pretty incredible, really, to have a 13-yard average running the ball from a quarterback. I mean, he only did it three times, but it just shows you how much pressure Marshawn Lynch takes off Russell Wilson. It's absolutely incredible.
Brandon, your biggest take?
It was a good game. Bad commercials.
Hey, the Breaking Bad one was pretty good. I mean, that one was pretty awesome, and that Pac-Man Budweiser Bud Light commercial, whatever it was, with Pac-Man was pretty awesome. I mean, there were some good ones.
No, yeah, there were some fun commercials. There were some, like, i.e. nationwide, that were just disastrous. But the MVP race honestly had a lot of contenders in it, and that's kind of speaks to how many big moments that this game had. It was just a back-and-forth affair. Yes, the Patriots really ultimately won both halves, but in the first half, they ended up going in tied because of the gutsy play call by Pete Carroll with 6 seconds left to go for the end zone and the tying score of going into halftime of Super Bowl 49. But as you touched on, Marshawn Lynch could have been the MVP with the second touchdown on the goal line for the Seahawks. And the thing is, Russell Wilson, with the exception of that pick, had a good day. He had almost 250 yards passing. He had the two touchdowns. But the Patriots' defense was, I mean, ultimately Malcolm Butler, the undrafted, the rookie free agent, who almost made a great play on the play that we thought was going to be immortalized, which was the Jermaine Kearse catch at the 5-yard line, where he caught it like 3 times. And the call wasn't nearly as good as the Antonio Freeman catch that it reminded me of. But and that Freeman catch will forever be, I think, probably the number one catch maybe ever. But that's just me. But the Kearse catch was ridiculous. And then on that first and goal from the 5, Marshawn Lynch was trucking towards the goal line, and Dante Hightower made a great play coming across the formation and just a flat-out effort stopping, with a little help from his friend, stopping Marshawn Lynch from beast-moding right into the end zone. And that brought on the substitutions that subsequently gave the Seahawks the look, which tempted them, and ultimately their decision was to go with a pass by Russell Wilson and try the pick play on the outside and such. But we're totally bearing the lead here, in my opinion. Malcolm Butler made an absolutely outstanding play on the ball. He, as soon as the ball snaps, he knows exactly where it's going, and he makes a break on the ball. The story of this should be Malcolm Butler made a great play. It's not that Russell Wilson screwed up. It's not that it can be debated whether Pete Carroll screwed up with the play call, but flat out, Malcolm Butler should and will eventually get credit for making one of the what will go down in history as one of the all time Super Bowl plays. Brandon, would you agree with that? Or
yeah, I think that there's arguments to be made for both MVP candidates, which would have been either Tom Brady or Malcolm Butler, because Tom Brady got them that far and Malcolm Butler saved the game. Pete Carroll made some outstanding decisions to put them to tie the game up before the half, just so he could throw the game away at the end.
I mean, the big thing that I look at it is that the end of the game wasn't so much Malcolm Butler making a great play. I mean, that was a great play made by Malcolm Butler. Like, there's no doubt about it. Like, that's one of those plays that's why they're professionals. And also, it's kind of a tribute to the coaching of Bill Belichick that he can get a rookie prepared to come in and be able to make a play like that in the Super Bowl is pretty impressive. But the biggest thing that I see about it is a couple things. First off, that Pete Carroll screwed up to an extent. I think he came out and said that they wanted to throw the ball once in that sequence down at the goal line, which I think is fine. You can come in there thinking that you're going to have to pass once. Like, I'm fine with coming in being prepared to do that. I don't know if you try it on second down per se, but I think that throwing the ball is definitely an option. I wouldn't throw slants across the middle. But the big thing is that, and they talked about this, I was watching some ESPN the other day, was that Pete Carroll comes out and they're like, they see, you know, their goal, the Patriots are running their goal line set, and that's why what made them decide to run the ball or to throw the ball instead of running it. Well, problem is, first off, is okay, they've got their big guys out there to try and stop Marshawn Lynch. You know, you've got guys that are gigantic, like Vince Wilfork, like guys, like a bunch of Vince Wilforks on the field ready to try and stop the run. So Pete Carroll's like, well, let's throw it. Well, according to what it sounds like from what they've been discussing on ESPN, that the guy that's communicating to Pete Carroll that the Patriots are in goal line kind of neglected to talk about the corners that were on the field, that basically he screwed up in not getting Pete Carroll the proper information. Because if it would have been what apparently most people seem to think Pete Carroll thought it was, that it was a straight up goal line, like blitz sort of situation, that slant across the middle would have been great and would have worked just fine. But because he didn't get the right information, it was a bad play call. The other thing I see is you can come in expecting to throw it at least once, but the logic that, well, they've got their big guys in there, therefore we are going to throw the ball, is where I have some issues, because they're probably not going to take their big guys off the field, because obviously you're going to at some point in that series hand the ball to Marshawn Lynch. So the whole idea that you're like throwing the ball because they're in goal line doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, but again, Malcolm Butler made a great play. Russell Wilson, I don't know if I necessarily agree with the throw choice. I might not have put the ball there in traffic like that. I mean, you don't really expect a guy to make that, but at the same time, though, it's the Super Bowl. You're trying to win. You don't want to throw it to where there's a possibility that that's going to happen. You want to hit an open receiver. Like the touchdown he threw earlier in the game to the – I can't remember who caught it, but Revis was covering him, and Revis got picked by the ref, and the guy was wide open. That's what kind of things I want to look for. I mean, obviously, it's never going to be that perfect, but you want guys to be as open as possible for me, especially on the goal line when you've got Marshawn Lynch. Rather than throwing the ball into traffic, just throw the ball away, look for an open receiver, do something else, and then just hand the ball off and move on.
Brandon, what'd you think?
Can we talk about the Seahawks next season? Because I just heard a report yesterday saying that Earl Thomas will be out for 6 to 8 months. And if Richard Sherman gets Tommy John surgery, he'll be out for 10 to 12 months.
No, yeah. And and that's another thing is the Seahawks secondary, by the end of this game, was really, really banged up. Jeremy Lane had that horrific arm injury, which I hope that we all hope and pray that he heals up from that right quick. But Cam Chancellor had a knee injury that he's having surgery on. You mentioned the Earl Thomas shoulder injury. And then Sherman has the injury where it's basically Tommy John surgery, but they don't want to call it that for whatever reason.
Yeah, but the problem is that I heard from, or at least I heard from a few different doctors saying that he doesn't need Tommy John surgery because he's a non-throwing athlete, and it's a, you know, the it's an ulnar ligament, which doesn't need Tommy John's.
Well, it is a possibility. But as far as the just the ebb and flow of this game itself, just the biggest comeback in Super Bowl history was made by the New England Patriots after overcoming a 10-point fourth quarter deficit to win this world championship. But just throughout the game, there were so many games that could have been, you know, the turning point, the play of the game. There was the missed throw on the route to Julian Edelman on the little in and out dodge kind of route that they went back to for the what ultimately ended up being the winning score, and just Brady just never flinching, staring down the barrel of a 2-pick day, but against the Legion of Boom, the best pass defense, especially specifically in the National Football League. But the reason that Brady is getting talked up as the greatest of all time now is not only because of the Montana records that I cited earlier, but partially because it was made, these plays were made against such a vaunted defense. But Edelman was huge in this game. He had a bunch of conversions like we talked about. He would probably most likely come up huge on that. Gronk, whenever he was man to man on a linebacker, they obviously exploited that, which is understandable. But the biggest thing I took away from this game was it was just a great, flat out great game. It lived up to the hype, and it was it wasn't exactly what we expected. It was exactly what Madden expected. They picked the Patriots to rally to a 28-24 victory. And I know we addressed that a little bit in our preview. But I don't think anybody expected. I certainly didn't expect them to be exactly right. I don't think any of us did. But that was a funny wrinkle as well. And it was just flat out a historically good game. I don't know about greatest Super Bowl of all time, but some people are calling it that. Like I've said before, I don't really like greatest of all time debates. And especially I personally would just like to appreciate it for what it was. It was an instant classic. And even though the brawl at the end was ugly and it was pointless and it showed poor sportsmanship, the Seahawks are going to be okay because of Russell Wilson. I do kind of disagree with you on Russell Wilson being like the problem. I would say that because of the way he's handled this, because just throwing a pick in the biggest spot on the biggest stage in his profession and one of the biggest stages in the world, like that, the way he's handled it, it has demonstrated to me what I already had a suspicion of, and that is that he is a leader that I would definitely take for my football team.
See, I beg to differ. I beg to differ a little bit that I think they're going to be fine to an extent. I think Russell Wilson is – he's a good quarterback. I wouldn't necessarily know if I'd trust him as the leader I want. I firmly believe that, like, he's a great leader and he's a great motivator, but I don't know if he's the guy I want for my team because I've seen the fact that what makes him scary, again, like I've said before, is having Marshawn Lynch there because you can't – especially when he tries to turn and run, it's hard to, you know, devote containment to a quarterback and a running back at the same time. It's a very difficult thing to do. And so that sets up his mobility very well, having to deal with that. But the biggest thing I think is that as a quarterback, everybody says he's a great game manager and he definitely does have his he does great at that. And he makes good throws. But the thing I see with him in particular is that when the game is put on him and they start throwing the ball because they're having problems running the ball or they're having problems, you know, with their offense, they start throwing the ball. That's when he really starts to struggle. You saw it in the NFC Championship game that threw picks and then everything just kind of started to snowball and it took somebody else to kind of pull him out and get him turned around to a point where he could then go in overtime and make those good throws that he did. And I think that's the difference between him and, like, Tom Brady, per se. And I know this is slightly an unfair comparison, but if you – well, I mean, Tom Brady, I would argue, is the greatest quarterback ever. But the thing is that Tom Brady throws two picks, doesn't seem to faze him all that much. I mean, it does, but he's not out there. It never seems to get away from him where I've seen that get away from Russell at some points. But the thing is that the Seahawks are also in the next couple of years set to lose a lot of players. And that could really hurt. And I think that could end up ultimately being their downfall is, are they going to be able to keep enough of their good players around to maintain to be good? Because they really need to keep Marshawn Lynch. I don't think there's much of a debate about that one. Unless you want to take a shot on Melvin Gordon, which is from all the mock drafts I've seen. I've seen Melvin Gordon everywhere that all of them say that all the mock drafts I've seen are saying that Melvin Gordon will go to the Seahawks, which they don't re-sign Marshawn Lynch. I definitely could see that happening, but they need a good solid running back and they need some, you know, they need to keep some guys on their defense, which as was reported in the last hour, it sounds like Ndamukong Suh actually wants to sign with the Seahawks, that they're his number one team, which I mean, that could be a great fit and make that defense scary, like utterly terrifying.
No question. That would make them extremely scary. I mean, they're scary already. They have a very tenacious defense.
Let's put him together with Richard Sherman, shall we?
Yeah. No, two things. Russell Wilson, he was the Seahawks offense for part of the year. But I do agree with you that that the supporting cast does help him, but I don't know how that's a knock on him. Like, and then the second thing is, we'll get this to more of this in our pre-draft stuff. But I've seen and heard, and it makes more sense to me for them to take like a Todd Gurley because it just seems like he's more similar to Marshawn Lynch. Marshawn Lynch is a beast, obviously, but we will get to that at a later date. Brandon, do you have any final thoughts on the Super Bowl?
I actually have to issue an apology to EA. I was a little bit disrespectful towards their simulations of the Super Bowl. I just want to say I'm sorry. It was very irresponsible of me to say those things, and it was very immature.
It happens. Not a lot of people thought that Madden was going to be as right as it was, but unfortunately, I mean, it happens. And if you look at, it was just the end of that game nobody saw coming, I think. And that's the thing that kind of makes it crazier was the way that game ended. And I think that's the biggest thing that's going to, you know, it's going to drive a lot of people crazy. It's just Seahawks fans are upset. There's conspiracy theories floating around that Pete Carroll called that play so Wilson would get the MVP. Just because the front office is might be looking to part ways with Marshawn Lynch. So that could be part of it. But there's a lot of things. But needless to say, Seahawks fans are getting driven nuts by the end of that game. And a lot of them, you know, might be needing to seek some rehab. Speaking of rehab, let's transition here to Johnny Manziel and the Cleveland Browns. Johnny Manziel obviously just checked into rehab on his own, it sounds like, to check in for some personality issues, it sounds like. What do you got to say about that, Kempson?
Well, I've been saying since pre-draft last year when they did end up trading around and eventually settling at 22 and taking Johnny Manziel, I wouldn't touch him. And it was just something that I had actually been convicted about since his last season in college. I thought he was Johnny College football. I didn't think he was going to be an NFL franchise quarterback. That being said, I hope that this is a turning point for him in his life, because I do feel like, apparently he does need help, and I didn't realize it was this bad, and I would never wish that upon anybody, really. And it sounds like that he's going to be back for training camp. And so I do hope that this, like I said, is a positive turning point in his life, because it seems like that his personal issues are something that I didn't even fully realize.
Yeah, I agree with Kempson. I didn't think that Johnny Manziel was worthy of a first-round pick, but I desperately want to see him succeed. I want to see what happens with Johnny's antics. I want to see him win games and throw touchdowns, and I want to see him farm that ego that we all know that he had during college. It would be fun to watch Johnny football in pro football, you know? It'd be fun. And I want to see Jameis Winston succeed too.
I mean, part of it is, especially with Manziel, I think, is that, and he's been, I think somebody who's on the record of saying, it might have even been Manziel himself that said basically he wasn't taking it super seriously. And I think this is kind of a turning point in the Johnny Manziel psyche that he can't just show up and get away with not putting in a lot of effort. And I have a feeling you're going to see Johnny Manziel make vast improvements. I feel like maybe not enough to get a starting job, but to move towards getting there, because he's taking personal responsibility, and there seems to be some fire lit under his rear end to make himself a better person. And I think a lot of that really stems from another Browns player that's been kind of in the news, is Josh Gordon. And he obviously just probably going to get suspended for at least a year, it sounds like.
He did, but, didn't he?
Well, it's not official yet. It sounds like he's going to be suspended for at least a year. But from my understanding, there's still some things that could happen with that could make it less, more. But he's going to get suspended for a period of time for his transgressions. But then again, if you read the letter that he wrote, or I mean allegedly wrote, there's people that say he had a PR person write it, but it sounds like Josh Gordon was trying to make himself a better person and just messed up. Like, that's all, like, just had one slip up and got caught. And I think, but the thing is, though, is regardless, I think that Josh Gordon taking responsibility for his own actions and saying, trying to make himself a better person, is admirable. And I think was kind of a big wake up call to Manziel. I really do, because I think it was really a big, big push for him. Because he just saw that one of his teammates, who was seen to be a lot like Johnny Manziel, and then has decided that, you know, that he had his own problems and needs to fix it, kind of is going to get Manziel himself to start making these changes and push towards being a better person, so he doesn't fall down the Josh Gordon rabbit hole, so to speak, which is kind of the same boat that Jameis Winston's in, if we want to talk about offseason and other issues too.
Well, and that's another thing we'll get to in more pre-draft type talk. But I've been saying since pre-draft that Cleveland, well, actually post-draft, I guess technically, that Cleveland's quarterback future, I believed, was starting for the Oakland Raiders all 16 games as a rookie. And I believe if Derek Carr gets some elite weapons and they build around him and Khalil Mack as cornerstones of their franchise, then the Raiders can return to the promised land. Brandon, did you have a point that you wanted to say?
Yeah, you guys heard about the rumor about Josh Gordon, right?
What rumor?
There was a rumor that he was drinking alcohol at Johnny Manziel's party.
Right, yeah, and that, yeah, well, yeah, I did hear that. And I also read the letter that you just cited, and it was, if it was Josh Gordon, I hope it was Josh Gordon, I really do. Because that would mark a turning, like you say, that would mark a turning point in his life. And that would be, I think that would be really, really good. I mean, especially with the Browns, because somehow all of a sudden they're kicking off their offseason with serious issues from the top down of the entire franchise.
You want to talk about the teams having issues. There's been all sorts of fire in the NFL right now. I mean, you have the Joseph Randall things are going on with him allegedly threatening to shoot his wife, threaten him with a gun, something like that. Involving his girlfriend or his wife with a gun. And then you had the Packers defensive tackle LaTroy Guyon getting caught with $190,000. A lot of marijuana and what sounds like illegal firearms. So things are not starting off well for the NFL in the aftermath of the Super Bowl.
Yeah, we also have Textgate and Deflategate and what else is there?
Right. Can we come up with a new thing for our scandals? I mean, I know that
I mean, the last scandal that didn't have gate attached to it was Monica Lewinsky, and that was 20 years ago. I think we need some more creativity. I mean, for reals.
We're not getting political on this podcast.
It was a joke.
No, I know. It was, and it was funny.
The only way we're going to get past this is if a guy named Gate gets in trouble. Then it's going to be like, oh, yeah, it's Gate, and they'll be like, oh, jeez, we just did it, didn't
we? They would still use it, I guarantee you. Just, I don't know. It's just cotton on. It's like a pop culture thing. I don't get it. I don't get it. But anyway, so there's no shortage of hot topics going into the off season. And so
the NBA seems to have its share of hot topics as well. Let's start with actually the most prominent that is taking place right now before we get to some of the teams that are on absolute fire right now, like the Hawks and the Cavs. But the big thing is, though, and this just happened last night with Chris Paul and the Clippers. We're going to have to try and – it's going to be a little bit of a careful ground we're going to have to tread. But there's been a firestorm surrounding Chris Paul and some of his comments he made after their loss to the Cavaliers. The Clippers were assessed 5 technical fouls in one game, which you'll be lucky to see one called a game. But what ended up happening was Chris Paul, they went to inbound the ball. And generally in an NBA game, basket's made, they take the ball, they inbound it. Well, the ref took the ball and wouldn't give him the ball, and Chris Paul asked for the ball. And the new rookie female ref, and I'm inserting this quite deliberately so for later in this conversation, is that basically she told him no, and then he asked why, and she teed him up. And then Blake Griffin got subsequently teed up for it. Matt Barnes was ejected after getting teched up twice. And ultimately, it ended up costing the Clippers the game. Chris Paul's actually quoting, saying that if that's how she wants to assess technicals, that she doesn't belong here, basically. This isn't for her. And that's created its own firestorm that we probably should stay about 50 feet away from.
No, but here's the deal. I think he's right. I think he's right, and I don't think this is about her being a woman. I think this is about her not being a fit ref. She shouldn't have called 5 technicals in her first game. I don't think – when was the last time that this happened to a rookie ref?
Well, she didn't call all 5 of them. But the bigger point here is that what ends up happening is refs costing teams games and refs doing things that are in games that ultimately, you know, can cost teams games and bad officiating. I mean, look at what happened in the NFL this year with a lot of bad calls, especially in the playoffs. I mean, that was huge. I mean, that's more where I'm seeing the big issue here is that what needs to be done about refs making bad calls?
Well, and we've said it before, especially in the game of basketball is where this might be arguably most prominent, is the fact that the referees have the most profound impact on the game, as far as the flow, as far as just giving certain advantages to with the fouls they call, their approach of either letting them play or, as they say, or, you know, whatever their approach happens to be. But I mean, in my opinion, I mean this in a figurative sense, and maybe this is a little off base, but it seems like people are more apt in modern days, for some reason, to have thick skulls as opposed to thick skin. And I believe that thick skin can help you more, especially when you're in the big spotlight of something like the NBA, the NFL, and so on and so forth. And that, I'm not just talking about her I'm not just zeroing in on her. I'm not attacking her in any way. In fact, you bringing this up is actually the first I've heard about it. So, and it's not an attack on her. It's just kind of an opinion that I have. Brandon, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, if she's going to, well, she didn't assess all those technicals, but some of them, you know, that's a problem. You know, maybe she'll grow and get beyond this, but, you know, hopefully she does. But if she doesn't, then maybe this isn't for her.
Yeah, and that's where I'm at, too, is that I feel like Joey Crawford is another NBA ref that has a notorious reputation for bad calls. Like, it happens to everybody, and he's been in the league for a long time. Like, he's a veteran referee, and he still does stuff that pisses the players off. So it has nothing to do with her being a rookie ref. It has nothing to do with her being a woman. It just has to do with the fact that she might have done some stuff, and the other refs might have done some stuff that cost the Clippers the game. On the flip side of the Clippers losing, however, is the Cavaliers winning that game, and they're now on a 12-game win streak.
Oh, boy, here
and
come
they
the
look
Cavaliers.
Good. And this is what I've been saying all season long. Just wait, because they're coming. And once they get going, I don't think there's a team in the NBA that can stop them. I mean, there's a couple teams I think that could give them problems, Golden State being one of them. I think the Clippers could actually give them a lot of problems, especially with, I mean, losing Matt Barnes in that game and getting him ejected doesn't help the Clippers and some other things. But I don't see there's many teams that are going to be able to beat the Cavs. LeBron has had multiple 30-point games in the last, since he came back from injury. K-Love's starting to look like K-Love of old. Kyrie Irving's looking good. That team is clicking, and they're on fire. And I think the whole NBA needs to be on notice that they are in trouble and should be afraid of that team, because they've got the best player in the league, and his leadership is going to make all the difference. I mean, what do you guys think?
Yeah, they're looking pretty good right now. Yeah, I don't know. They're 31-20. They're two games behind the Toronto Raptors, 1.5. I don't know, something in that range, but it's going to be a long way up if you want to catch the Hawks right now. They're 10.5 games behind the Hawks. They're actually 2.5 games behind the Toronto Raptors.
And as you mentioned, the Hawks just got off a January that made their starting five, their entire starting five, of Jeff Teague, Paul Millsap, Al Horford, Kyle Korver, and Damari Carroll. Gosh dang it. They were the Eastern Conference players of the month, that entire starting five, because they finished the month of January with the same number that's on Jeff Teague's jersey in the loss column. 17-0, first NBA team in history to go an entire month undefeated. And I mean, are the Hawks obviously we just addressed the Cavaliers, but I believe the Hawks still have the best record in the East, and tonight they play the Golden State Warriors, who they have the best record in the West, correct?
Yep.
Are these two teams is this a possible NBA Finals preview, JT?
Well, I don't think so, because my problem is right now is I think the Hawks are a little overblown. Obviously they're winning games. They're 41-9, and that's insane. But the way I look at it, that kind of is a big thing is that the East is generally considered to be the weaker of the two conferences. So that is automatically a knock in my book, just because if you look at Golden State, well, Golden State has lost one less game but has played overall two less, or three less, actually, mm-hmm. It looks like. So the big thing here is that the way I see it, Golden State is still the overall team to beat. But the big issue is that if you look at Atlanta, they're shooting the ball well. Kyle Korver's at 53.9% from the three-point line, which is pretty crazy. But the thing is I don't know if they're going to be able to stop a team like Golden State, who has more than one guy that's absolutely a monster at shooting threes and is going to be able to beat the best team out of the West, the far more stacked conference. The other thing is that the Hawks haven't been having to deal with the healthy Cavaliers all season. And that's kind of the big thing is that I think my finals prediction right now is going to be probably Golden State and Cleveland would be my pick as of right now. And I've been kind of saying it all year that that's been my tentative pick because I've been waiting for the Cavs to kind of wake up. But if the Cavs didn't make it, the Bulls are pretty scary as well. Their biggest problem, ironically, is their biggest weapon from 3 years ago, was Derrick Rose, because Derrick Rose shoots the ball too much. And that's like his efficiency is pretty bad right now, like his scoring efficiency. So If he can fix that, the Bulls become automatically a lot scarier. And there's just a lot of teams in the East that with a few adjustments could become equally as scary.
And the player of the month in January out of the Western Conference was James Harden. Do the Rockets shoot too many threes?
Well, the Rockets, the thing is if you're winning games, there's really, I don't believe there's such a thing as shooting threes, too many threes. Like, if you're making them and you're winning games, keep doing what's working. Biggest problem with the Rockets I see, though, is the health of Dwight Howard's huge because he's out for at least a month, it sounds like. He got hurt. I can't remember what's wrong with him off the top of my head, but he's hurt and not looking so good. Harden's good. I think he might be the overall league MVP this year. I think there's a very strong argument that could be made. He's scoring the ball a lot, and he's playing really well. But I think if you want to look at a team that plays a lot like the Rockets, that I think is the better team, would be the Thunder. Because the Thunder, I would take Durant, Ibaka, and Westbrook over the guys in Houston. And that's what I'm looking at is that I think that the two teams in the West to beat are the Warriors and the Thunder. The only reason the Thunder are not in playoff contention or are a couple games out of the playoffs right now is because they've spent the first couple months of the season without Durant and Westbrook. So I think those are the two real scary teams out of the West. And I think, but that's just it. And there's no such thing as shooting too many threes if you're making them. And the three-point contest is going to be crazy too with Bellinelli, Harden, Curry, Klay Thompson, Korver, Kyrie Irving,
JJ Redick,
and I think that's it off the top of my head. Mm-hmm. So
that's crazy.
A heck of a lot better than the slam dunk contest, likely.
Well, those are dunk contests have been a joke for years, though. I mean, it just doesn't work. But I mean, I guess the one other big NBA story is Hassan Whiteside. Where did this kid come from? He gets a triple-double in a game and then is put up multiple 20-plus board games, which means he's getting over 20 rebounds. That's insane. He came out of nowhere. Just like this Whiteside kid out of nowhere. We talked about NBA All-Star snubs at one point, I'm pretty sure. And this kid came out after the voting and has just come out of nowhere. He should be an NBA All-Star with those numbers. If he had been there all season and doing this, he'd be an All-Star. This kid's insane. I don't know where he came from, but it's crazy. Him and Chris Bosh on the same team, like, scary. Just absolutely scary.
Yeah, I think they're going to probably move Chris Bosh to power forward. But let's talk about their other teammate, a guy that's coming up as a shooting guard. 6'3", undrafted rookie free agent from Fresno State this year, Tyler Johnson, came close to getting a double-double in one of their recent games off the bench.
That's cool. He'll come off the bench and hopefully represents the Dogs well. I mean, I think Paul George is still unquestionably the premier Fresno State Bulldog alumni in the National Basketball Association. Mm-hmm. And we hope and pray that he, or I do at least, that he continues on the road to recovery, because apparently, is he dunking again?
Yes, JT? He's dunking. And
absolutely. He's been dunking for about a month.
Yeah, he's been dunking. He's looking good. He also hinted at a comeback on Twitter.
Yeah, he's hinting at a comeback before the season's over, actually, is the rumor. Mm-hmm. But that's just it. So, speaking of impressive comebacks for players suffering freak injuries, let's transition to UFC 183 and the return of the Spider, Anderson Silva. He made the return over the weekend to, well, theoretically defeat one of the Diaz brothers, Nick Diaz, and that was quite the spectacle, to say the least. Everybody that was saying there was no trash talk was completely wrong. First couple seconds of the fight, there was wow. And I guess Kempsey just showed me the Wikipedia page. Somebody changed the result on the Wikipedia page for this fight to a no contest. But Anderson Silva defeated Nick Diaz by unanimous decision. More or less was the scorecards came back 49-46, all in favor of Anderson Silva. I was actually pretty impressed with his comeback. He looked really, really good. He looked like old Anderson Silva, but I think the bigger story is obviously going to be the PEDs. But the fact is that I think somebody – I actually had two of the rounds at least going to Diaz. I think Diaz was landing the harder shots and was doing, I think, better in terms of in a couple of the rounds at least. I don't know if I necessarily think he lost four of the five rounds. I just think that Diaz did a very good job. He came out, they touched gloves, and immediately he starts talking trash. Just immediately. He laid on the ground at one point for no reason. He, like, turned his back and acted like he was twerking, and it was just this ridiculous amount of trash talk. And Anderson did not know how to handle it, it looked like at first. Like, he didn't know what was going on. He adjusted, looked absolutely sensational, looked like old Anderson Silva. It was a great fight. I think it was, it was a good return for Anderson minus the PEDs, which we'll get more in depth with that in a minute. Cause I think there is a lot of controversy surrounding this card. So we'll just kind of address that kind of all at once. I think would be the best thing.
Can I say one thing? I think that the marijuana that Nick Diaz used was a PED because I think he was struggling to be creative before the fight. Like, how am I going to trash talk him? And then he's like, oh, you know what? I'm going to smoke a little bit of weed and get creative with my trash talk.
I mean, who knows? One of my buddies told a joke. He's like, I bet him and his brother stayed up all night just planning the first like 50 seconds of the fight and how they were going to just goof around. And I don't know, but it was the trash talk was cool. But this card overall, the rest of the fights were pretty disappointing. Tyron Woodley beat Kelvin Gastelum by split decision, basically 29-28. It was split decision 28-29, 29-28, 30-27. This fight, I was expecting to be an absolute slugfest and be a pretty good fight, and it was boring. It turns out Tyron Woodley broke his foot in the first round, which might be why it was really boring, because he wasn't really doing much. He was throwing a few shots. Kelvin was really pushing the pace, but unfortunately for him, I actually think Kelvin won. I had him winning two of the three rounds, actually, myself. But Kelvin came in overweight by almost 10 pounds because
he was a middleweight.
He had the flu is what happened. So he was actually at 174 before the weigh-ins and his coaches were like, he was going to make it, but he had the flu earlier in the week and ultimately it came back and sent him to the hospital and they made him rehydrate, which is why he came over 10 pounds over rather than only maybe even only a pound over, which would still technically be within the weight limit. So he would have been fine. He's actually going to be forced to jump weight. So that happened. Al Iaquinta defeated Joe Lozon by TKO in the second round. That was a fight. Those two guys were throwing bombs. It was great. It was just it was a war. That was a fun fight to watch. I think big things are ahead of Al Iaquinta. I think he just signed a fight on – trying to think of who we just signed to fight. I think it might be Masvidal. I'm gonna look real quick.
Did he just fight Masvidal? I think he might have.
I'm trying to remember. He just got he's fighting Jorge Masvidal April 4th in place of I think Benson. It might have been Benson's fight originally. But so Al Iaquinta's got a big fight ahead of him. So that was a good fight. And then in my personal pick for fight of the night was on Talis Latis defeating Tim Bosch by a submission. He caught him in an arm triangle in the second round. Bosch was throwing bombs. Like, he knocked him down. He was beating the crap out of him and then got caught. But it was like those guys were throwing punches. It was great. It was a good fight.
I can confirm that Al Iaquinta will be fighting Jorge Masvidal. By the way, you mentioned Ben Henderson. is moving up to
we'll get to that in a minute. Let's finish talking about the card, okay. And then we'll talk about other news, because there's a lot of UFC news that's come out in the last couple days. Mm-hmm. So, and then Thiago Alves defeats Jordan Mayne with a body kick in the second round. Thiago Alves is getting his butt stomped. First round, not looking so good for Thiago. Jordan Mayne pressured him, was just bigger and just really taking it to him. And then Alves, in straight like Anthony Pettis style, just drills him with one of the hardest body – or Lyoto Machida style, just drills him with a body kick and just dropped him, and it was over, which was thoroughly impressive. Alves, I think, is back, and he's – I think he'll be making a run for it, because he obviously fought GSP for the title and then got hurt and has kind of had his career sidetracked. Mm-hmm. I think he'll be back. Misha Tate defeated Sarah McMahon. Pretty controversial that one was. I didn't see the whole fight. I actually went to a bar originally to watch it, and ended up going to the bar. They didn't have the fights on, so I missed most of that fight. But from my understanding, the first two rounds, Misha Tate was really getting her rear end handed to her. So there's a lot of people that think that Sarah McMahon won that fight. And that fight was actually a pretty big fight in that division. I think Misha's probably going to get a shot at whoever's above her in the rankings for probably a title shot after Kat Zingano gets her crack at her at Ronda. So that was actually a pretty big fight. And that's pretty much all the big fights on that card. As far as other UFC news goes, Benson Henderson's jumping weight to welterweight. Because I guess he's going to be fighting Brandon Thatch. Mm-hmm. So that'll be interesting. I don't know how he's going to hold up at welterweight. He's always been a pretty electric fighter. And I think the added weight might give him increased power and things like that. So it could be a good fight. What do you think, Brandon?
I think could be a good fight. Brandon Thatch is dangerous at welterweight, and Benson Henderson, has he ever fought at welterweight? I don't know.
As far as I know, he hasn't.
I would say the same. I don't know. But it's pretty crazy. Well, that fight all got jump-started because of Stephen Wonderboy Thompson was forced out of that fight with an injury. Talk about fighters out of that Chris Weidman camp. The camp with Matt Serra and all those
Ray
guys.
Longo.
Yeah, Ray Longo.
Yeah, Ray Longo, Team Serra Longo. Yeah. Weidman's out with a rib injury. That's not good. I think a lot of people are thinking he's ducking Vitor, and I don't necessarily think that's the case. A rib injury is nothing to scoff at, and having a broken hand like he had earlier, equally nothing to scoff at. So that's unfortunate. That's really going to – that main event, it sounds like they're trying to get Vitor to fight somebody. Mm-hmm. They offered him Lyoto Machida, and he turned it down, but – rumor is that he was offered another fight, mm-hmm. and they weren't confirming who it was for an interim belt. But rumor, yeah. And that was before these drug results came back, which rumor has it that Anderson Silva might be fighting Vitor Belfort. It's not official, but it sounds like that was the fight he was offered. So could be interesting.
Yeah, I also heard that he's probably going to – well, he was offered Gegard Mousasi, Lyoto Machida. He was offered another fight, and he was offered that mystery fight, which you also mentioned.
Well, before we get to, like you just touched, kind of alluded to, the drug issues, the couple medical leaves have been taken with Misha Tate and Tyron Woodley. I believe it was reported that they may be out to, up to 6 months is the report I heard, and but at any rate the more pressing issue is the drug deal, pardon the expression, which included both main event participants Nick Diaz and Anderson Silva tested positive for drugs. One of them was a PED, which was the Silva tested positive for Drostanolone.
It was
Nick Diaz tested positive
steroid.
For marijuana.
I don't know what kind of anabolic steroid. I'm not familiar with steroids all that well. I know that it helps you recover from injuries.
Well, there's a couple things about this. It's problem is it doesn't matter what he took and what it does. It's the manner that he got caught with it. It's kind of the big issue. Because returning from injuries, I mean, like Tyron Woodley and Misha Tate are both going to have like a long recovery against them, even though they can return a pending clearance. But when Anderson Silva got hurt, that was like a freak injury. Like that's happened three times as far as I know of. Twice in the UFC, once to in another organization.
It happened in Glory Kickboxing when Tyrone Spong went up against Gokhan Saki.
Yeah, that it happened there. But the big thing is the more pressing thing is not that it happened and the fallout. I think Anderson Silva's done, first off. I think he basically called it a career after the fight was over anyway. He kind of was like, my kids don't want me to fight. I think I'm done. The big issue here is not what should happen moving forward, but should be what's the effect on Anderson Silva's legacy after this. Because a lot of people consider Anderson Silva to be the greatest fighter of all time. And that's where this really runs into some problems. Because it's like the two big names that generally come to mind – well, there's three really. Some people argue Fedor, and I don't know how much I buy that one. But the two big names are generally GSP and Anderson Silva. Anderson Silva getting caught puts the UFC in an interesting predicament. Because he got caught and he's never been tested out of competition from a lot of people's understanding is that he doesn't really get drug tested very often. And the one time he does, he gets caught. So the question is how long has Anderson Silva been taking steroids is kind of the big question. Because if he really has been taking them for most of his career, we might never find out. But the fact of the matter is it's a matter of legacy. Because Anderson Silva's legacy is extremely important to the UFC. Because you have Chris Weidman's one of the biggest draws in the UFC, even though his last couple pay-per-views, if he's been with Ronda. And so the problem is she is in the top five biggest draws. Actually, I think she's probably top three now that Anderson and GSP have stacked back. It's probably her, Conor McGregor, and Jon Jones are probably the three big draws. Is that you have, but then you've got Chris Weidman. He's a big draw. And they always amp up his fights as he's the guy that beat Anderson Silva. He beat the greatest of all time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's huge. You have this, it's a huge thing for the UFC to maintain Anderson Silva's legacy. Because without it, it's like, well, the guy they say was the greatest of all time and they've been hyping up got caught using drugs. What about the rest of the fighters? You get guys all the time that get caught. It leaves the UFC in a really, really awkward predicament. Like, wouldn't you guys say?
Yeah.
Well, he was certainly not the first one to get caught either is part of it. Brandon.
Yeah, but before Anderson Silva got caught and before they jumped to this new type of drug testing that the UFC is doing recently, there was really not much of a way that they could find steroids in a person's drug tests. It was mostly in the blood work.
Well, yeah, and that is the goal is when you institute kind of a new drug program like they have it's the goal is to weed out more of the offenders and they've been successful, wouldn't you say?
I mean, they've been successful to a point, but the thing is the UFC is just – they got to do something about it. They need to make sure their fighters get off the PEDs, especially their big-name fighters, and they need to start – like this has been the big story for a long time is these big-name fighters are getting away with stuff, and they have been. Like look at Jon Jones. Got caught with cocaine before the fight, and they still let him fight. Then we find out afterwards. It's like, well, hang on. You get caught with cocaine, and they're just like, he's going to rehab. He'll be fine.
Yeah, like, okay. The Anderson Silva steroid test was before the fight, too. That was a pre-fight.
Well, it didn't
test.
Come back till afterwards, though. And that's because it was taken and their lab results aren't The commission is still getting used to how they're handling these drug tests. I believe it. They're trying to get it down to less than a week now, which if they do that, that'll be key. The big thing they need to do, though, is they've got to catch it early, and they need to start instituting harsh penalties for these guys that get caught. With PED specifically, with marijuana in Diaz's case, while it's a big deal, is not the biggest of deals because it's not really a thing that's going to give you an unfair advantage other than maybe you're a little stoned when you get into the octagon. I mean, that's not the – it's not really the biggest of a performance enhancer like steroids are. And that's a big thing. But they need to start, you know, suspending guys, taking guys' titles away, doing things that are going to say, if you want to take steroids, you're going to be in some trouble. Like, they need to take a stand against it because they're kind of caught in a baseball predicament right now. I mean, they really are. You have guys like – In baseball, they had Barry Bonds got caught. Alex Rodriguez did them. You know, you've got all these guys that get caught with them, and it's like, well, all the really great players took steroids for a while, and it questions the legitimacy of an era. The UFC is still an up-and-coming sport. That is a problem. They need to quell this issue and get moving on.
Okay, I've got something. This is probably going to be controversial, but I don't know if steroids have that much impact in the sport, though, because they do have weight classes, and steroids doesn't help you add muscle. It just helps you recover.
Well, so here's the thing, is that it has nothing to do with steroids. That's HGH is what helps you add muscle. Generally, is human growth hormone is generally the steroid, from my understanding. The thing is that there are steroids that help you come back from injuries faster. There's steroids that, you know, can make you go faster. There's steroids that do a lot of different things. And the thing is here is that you got a guy that was, you know, arguably the greatest of all time, comes back from a freak injury to come fight, and then he gets caught with steroids. Sure, they help you recover faster. But the thing is that if you're using steroids that help you gain muscle, for instance, you're going to have more muscle on your frame, and muscle might weigh more than fat, but when you cut weight down and you get down to that weight, when you cut back up, it's hard to deal with a guy that's built and is strong and has a lot of muscle, because they're going to be able to push you around, manhandle you in the cage, and do a lot of things to people that normally you could not get away with because they're so much stronger and they're so much more built. Because coming and take this from experience, I'm a guy that did Taekwondo for 9 years, has quite a bit of experience doing jiu-jitsu, doing other things like that. Fighting guys that might weigh the same as me but are more muscular than me, and especially in like wrestling too, it's the same thing, is that it is harder to deal with a guy that's stronger than you because he has more muscle. And it does give you an unfair advantage because you can punch harder. There's some steroids that can make you not feel pain as much too, that's considered performance enhancers, that do all kinds of different things that can give you an unfair advantage. And the thing is if Silva was taking steroids to come back from the injury that are like to help him heal, that's one thing. But that's when he's not signed to do a fight. You know, there's all kinds of things that go into it that they do give you an unfair advantage, especially if they help make you stronger. So like, say I'm John Jones. John Jones pushes guys against the cage and holds them there. If I'm stronger, John Jones, because I've got more muscle on my frame, I might weigh the same, but I'm still going to be able to push you against a cage and hold you there. And you're probably not going to be able to get out. It's kind of like, you know, if you ever watch Kimbo Slice's fight against Roy Nelson, it's kind of a similar thing, except Roy Nelson's fat and Kimbo just gets caught under his fat rolls and couldn't get out. Like, that's basically what happened, is because he got trapped. But with the muscle, it's a similar thing, except it's not that you're trapped. It's that you can't get them off because they're so much stronger than you.
Yeah. And Roy Nelson's going to be fighting Alistair Overeem pretty soon. And Roy Nelson's actually the underdog here. What do you think about that?
Not the end of the world. I think Alistair Overeem's an animal. And it's, the guy beat Brock Lesnar. I mean, he's obviously – and he was great before he got to the UFC. Alistair Overeem is an animal, and Roy Nelson's kind of on the declining end of his career. And if Alistair puts on a really good performance, absolutely he should be the favorite. But the thing is, though, is that I don't care who the favorite and who the underdog is. It just matters how they show up on fight day. Ask TJ Dillashaw about how he feels about being an underdog. Ask Henan Barao about how he feels about being a favorite. The biggest sports upset last year was Henan Barao getting destroyed by TJ Dillashaw. It doesn't, yeah. Anybody can, it's like football. It's like saying any given Sunday. Well, once you get in there, it takes one punch to completely change the way your night's going on either side. Mm-hmm. Betting to me doesn't really matter. It's especially in a sport where one little thing can change it. It's not like football where, yeah, you throw an interception, you've got time to come back. If you get hit once and you get your bell rung, sometimes you can't come back from that because you do not recover. Trust me, I know from experience. It sucks. Yep.
By the way, about that Dillashaw-Barao matchup, we actually have confirmation that there will be a second fight. I believe that one will be taking place in Brazil this time.
It's in April.
No, it's actually in Quebec, Canada.
It's in April, if I'm not mistaken. It's like April 18th, I think, off the top of my head. Something like that. It's in April, yeah. I'm pretty sure, though.
Yeah.
It'll be a good fight.
On that card. So, and Hector Lombard taking on Rory McDonald, Fabio Maldonado, and the return of Quentin Rampage Jackson, CB Dalloway, Michael Bisping, and Patrick Cote taking on, I believe this is the return fight for Joe Riggs, too.
Yeah, it'll be a good card. And then the other big, I guess, fight that got signed to is, I guess, it's pretty much official. Jose Aldo, Conor McGregor is going to take place in July. Mm-hmm. So that'll be good. But speaking of getting things signed, let's kind of move on to our final topic of the day and talk about National Signing Day in college football.
Which was earlier this week. And, you know, the approach on the recruiting trail is to pull no punches to try to get all your prospects in there on National Signing Day. And the big takeaways from the rankings I'm looking at here on ESPN is the top five were in this order by ESPN's metrics: Alabama, Florida State, USC, Clemson, Tennessee. That's the top five recruiting classes in the nation. Tennessee, that's interesting to me. And I don't know. I would like to see Tennessee kind of return to prominence, but that's just me. Brandon, did you have any key takeaways as far as the National Signing Day?
Yes, I do. And this is pretty interesting. I heard a few different ESPN anchors say that they're worried about Alabama. Why are they worried about Alabama? There's not really much to worry about with Alabama. They don't have to reset. They just reload. They've got all the talent that they need. They got all the five-star prospects that they need. And Nick Saban as your head coach, Lane Kiffin as your offensive coordinator. And Kirby Smart as your defensive coordinator. With that group, you don't really have to worry about that much. But they're still worried. Why is that?
That they're worried about Alabama? I don't know. They have Alabama ranked as the number one recruiting class by ESPN's metrics, and it depends on where you go as far as the point system. I know Rivals has a different system, and there's several different sources that you can go to for your recruiting rankings. But I mean, I don't know. Maybe it has to do with the fact that Auburn ended up getting the number one prospect in the nation by many accounts, Byron Cowart, a defensive end from Florida. That may have been part of it, but it's just recruiting, and but obviously this is the future of college football, and it does seem that the SEC, shockingly, made off with a lot of high quality prospects, and then USC, we would expect, at least I'm expecting them to kind of get back on the wagon, so to speak, on a national scale. And Florida State is right up there with a couple of top 10 prospects coming in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, speaking of USC briefly, there was I think one of the coolest things I saw coming out was the cornerback from he's from California originally. The Bleacher Report actually, they helped him put together like a like kind of an inspirational music video that was like his trip through like life and like where he's been and like what football's done for him. And then, like, he announces his decision in, like, a music video of, like, where he was going to school. And he ended up deciding he was going to stay and go to USC. And that was really cool. Like, normally I'm like, okay, that's a little too much hype for one player, especially a high schooler who has done really relatively nothing. And that's been kind of the – there's been, I think, some NFL players or, and like, analysts who say, you haven't accomplished anything yet. You don't get this sort of hype. But it was cool because he's like – he just basically at the end of it's like, I'm staying home. And it's just a picture of him in a Trojans hat. And it's really cool. It's really cool. Check it out. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, no. The National Signing Day has changed a lot actually in recent years because of the role that social media and such plays in a new era of that kind of stuff, just with all the big old players having their Twitter accounts and everything and just having that kind of up to the second updates on everything. It's just become quite the hoopla. And as far as the hype and everything, well, you could make an argument that everything's overhyped in society at this point. But yeah, I mean that I'll have to go look at that because that actually sounds like a lot of fun. Has a little like you said, it has the staying home kind of tug to it, and that'd be pretty cool to see. Brandon, do you have anything else to say on National Signing Day?
Yeah, how about Cordell Broaddus, son of Snoop Dogg, instead of choosing what many people thought he would choose, they thought he would go to USC. He decided that he would go to UCLA, and Snoop Dogg, also tagging onto the decision, said that he is throwing away all his USC Trojans gear and just getting UCLA stuff now. How about that?
Well, that's good, I guess. I mean, for a father supporting his son, that's fine. But I guess that could also kind of go into my argument about the hoopla and how stuff can get overdone, I guess. But I actually saw a couple of episodes of the reality show they made out of his journey towards college football, and actually it wasn't half bad, but. Yeah, I mean, a father supporting his son. I mean, I have no problem with that.
Yeah, that's how I feel. It was really cool. It was like pretty I mean, it was one of those things that was just like one of those cool stories that was someone that a lot of people already knew who he was and was, you know, already a fairly recognizable figure that was also slightly disconnected from a lot of people too. A lot of people think Snoop Dogg, all he does is sit around and get high. I mean, that's kind of true. I mean, he Snoop Dogg came to where I'm originally from, Great Falls, a couple of years ago and played a concert. And the GFPD actually was like, we're going to arrest him if he gets on stage and smokes weed because that's what he does. Like, that's just what they assume he does. But really, like, Snoop Dogg really does care about his kid, and that was awesome. Like, it was just truly, truly a cool thing to witness and to get to watch. You know, a guy that a lot of people just think probably wouldn't care, support his son and show like this really close bond was a really, really awesome thing.
And going back to your original point, Brandon, I don't know. I mean, most of the metrics have Alabama and USC, some of them do, but Alabama having the top recruiting hall in the nation. And I don't know that Alabama is as long as Nick Saban is the coach at Alabama. Well, and obviously Urban Meyer is the coach at Ohio State, and right now they are the favorites, I would say, to repeat as the champions of college football. But I don't know. I don't think Alabama's in trouble. I don't see that. But then again, that's kind of preseason talk, and that's kind of for August. So
I want to talk about this now.
I know you do.
Let's talk about I'm going to just get off on a tangent here. Who do you think is going to be the favorite for next year other than Ohio State? Who do you think is going to get into the playoffs?
I don't really have a pick other than Ohio State. I mean, TCU, I could see them. Mm-hmm. But the Big 12 might get shut out again. It could happen, which would be interesting because that would really compel them to get a championship game or do something. But I think it's kind of an overreaction to do it right off the bat right now. But I think Ohio State is definitely the favorite, like I said, to repeat as the champion. And as far as like a dark horse type team, I might take Notre Dame because their schedule is, by Notre Dame standards at least, apparently not too terribly rigorous, which might have the fact that they're playing the ACC more than the Big Ten nowadays might have something to do with that. But their toughest games really is playing on the road in Death Valley against Clemson and then on the road against Stanford. I think that's their two toughest, at least road games. And if they get the quarterback situation figured out, they were one of the youngest teams in the nation last year. And so they have all that experience is what that means coming back. And so, I mean, this isn't just a personal homer pick because I have a little bit of family ties to Notre Dame. I do like the Golden Domers, but I do think that Notre Dame has a shot, especially with Brian Kelly as a coach, as long as we're talking about coaching and how important that is to the college football game.
I think
Penn State hauling in the number two recruiting class in terms on ESPN, at least they pulled in the number two recruiting class in the Big Ten. Are they poised to have a good season?
I mean, maybe. I don't know. Who knows? Penn State, they could be good. I don't know. We'll just have to wait and see because I think the big thing is right now is you just got to look at teams that have a lot of established talent already rather than sitting here going, well, what was the recruiting class like? Like, I don't know enough about Penn State and who their seniors they lost were and what they needed to fix were from last year. So, I mean, that could be good. But the way I see it, there's a couple teams I really think. I'm with Kempston on Notre Dame. I think they'll be really good, especially they get the quarterback thing figured out. They'll be great. I think Alabama obviously is a team that I think will be really good. But I also think Oregon's going to do really well. I think Oregon, they have a system in place that's really hard for a lot of teams to deal with. And they might lose some seniors, but I think that if they get the right quarterback, they still have the pieces around that team to really make a push. I think they could be a contender. I think they could definitely win the Pac-12. I think that could happen. But the other team, the team I think is in trouble, though, is Florida State. And I say that because they had too many problems in the first half last year. And they're losing some key guys. Jameis Winston obviously being the biggest name, even though I think that they need a quarterback that's not going to throw interceptions. Jameis Winston threw like 24 touchdown passes and like 17 interceptions last year, which is not good. I think if they can get a quarterback that cuts down on those interception numbers, they'll be doing fine. But the problem is they got to get one. The most obvious choice, I guess, is that there's been actually a push along amongst the student like population, I guess, at Florida State to try and get Braxton Miller or JT Barrett from Ohio State to snag one of them, which if they did that and could get one of them to come over, then they might be in good shape. But they need a QB or else they're in trouble.
Yeah, I've heard that Braxton Miller is looking to transfer. I don't know what the likelihood of JT Barrett transferring is. I've heard that if Braxton Miller doesn't win the starting job, he'll probably be leaving Ohio State to go somewhere else, maybe even jumping in the supplemental draft.
Well, JT Barrett is younger, so he might even stay. Like there was a scenario that's been brought up where Cardale Jones is actually, say he wins the starting job or whatever, and then JT Barrett sticks around because Cardale Jones, there was a scenario that I heard from, I believe it was ESPN Championship Drive with Reese Davis that I listened to. Where Cardale Jones stayed and he was actually the starter going in, and then JT Barrett stuck around because he has more eligibility than Cardale Jones. So even if he just waited it out and did kind of like a Blake Sims, I guess is what comes to mind, kind of type of approach to it, then I mean that would be good for Ohio State because that would mean they were basically, I mean, by for all intents and purposes from what we've seen, set at quarterback for almost 5 years. So that's kind of nice. But, I mean, I talked about USC a lot when we were talking about National Signing Day, and I somehow forgot to mention them as a playoff contender. I think they are a playoff contender. They can make some. Sparty also could be a dark horse in the Big Ten, Michigan, with the Michigan State Spartans. But I mean, the fact that USC returns their quarterback Cody Kessler and Oregon does not, especially someone the caliber of Marcus Mariota, I believe is an advantage for the Trojans.
Well, I mean, I think the other thing is let's backtrack to Ohio State for a minute. I think that having a good being set at quarterback's a good thing, and that was what the Ducks had for the last couple of years, was having Mariota. And I mean, that's kind of the big thing. And I think I agree that the Trojans are going to be could be a great team, and I think they will be. But I think, again, it just comes down to what's going to happen with Notre Dame, because they're – or not Notre Dame, Oregon, because they're already a pretty set team. Like, they've – I mean, yeah, they lost their quarterback, but if you can get the right pieces there and around that, you get a quarterback in there that's going to work, they will continue to be good. And the other just now that I'm thinking about this, the other weird Ohio State situation I heard was that Braxton Miller moves to running back and Cardale Jones is the QB and JT Barrett's the backup, which could be a very interesting situation. However, I think that with how good they thought Braxton Miller – before he got hurt, was widely considered to be a Heisman candidate. Same thing with JT Barrett. Was it? I don't know if Braxton's going to want to give up his chance at the Heisman with how, you know, with already being known as a guy that is a candidate for it to move to running back.
Yeah, that's true. We've addressed that as well, Brandon and I, about the Braxton Miller moving positions. Yeah, I agree with you. I think as far as if he's looking towards the future more so, it would definitely be the right decision, because I don't see him as having a quarterback future at the next level. So if he's looking towards a future in the NFL and that's what he's banking on, then I think that would be the right decision. But if he wants to take one last shot at a national championship, then maybe Brandon, like you said, it might be a better option to jump over to Florida State or one of those other contenders.
Or Oregon.
That would be pretty fun. Because Oregon didn't just lose Marcus Mariota. They lost Ifo Ekpraolamu, who before his injury was the top corner in the draft, arguably. And I mean, they lose a couple other big names like Tony Washington, and who was a stud on their defense. So, I mean, I don't mean to get on some Oregon hate train or anything. I'm just saying that's a lot to lose and still be in the national championship hunt. I think they can make some noise, though. I do agree with you that the Ducks are a program that shouldn't be dismissed.
Well, I think they're hungry for a national title, too. I think that is the big thing, is that they want that national title. I mean, they've come close a couple of times and fallen short, and I think they want it. I think they want it really, really badly. So I think they're going to go hard and try and do something to get it. But and also that Nike sponsorship they have is huge. Like that will always be a big thing. But I don't know. But that's a long ways off. Long ways off.
Yeah, it is, and we've been on here a long time. So this is where we say goodbye for now. But before we do that, we ask you that we are on iTunes, and also Podomatic is our backup to iTunes. But we are on iTunes, and so we would love for you to download, subscribe, and leave your feedback, because we really want to improve ourselves, and we would like some feedback to kind of base that off of, and not just talk at each other. So, and we would thank you in advance for that.
Also, we are on Facebook as well. So if you look up Championship Sportscast on Facebook, we're on there. We're on Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter at Champion Sports 5.
Right. Yes, we are on both Twitter and Facebook now. And yeah, at Champion Sports 5, like Brandon said. Brandon is at LeeBrandon523. JT is the Danger Zone, capital MT. And I am Kempson Cross with capital K, capital C. And yeah, but the, all those Twitter handles are also, I believe, in the description of our Twitter account. So we would love to get your feedback. And yeah, I mean, we appreciate your feedback in advance, and we also appreciate you listening to the podcast. And yeah, so this has been the Championship Sportscast. For John Thomas, JT, Brandon Lee, I'm Kempson Cross, saying goodbye till next time.
Enjoy yourselves.